So, my name is David Oakley. I have a lot of conflicts of interest. I'm a data hog. I'm a CEO of a company called Wavi, and we collect data, brain data. And it's also this collaboration is with the University of Colorado and the Applied Math Department, Athletic Department, and the CU Health Science Center. So that's my disclosures. Right, so I'm going to talk about the end of an era, so-called end of an era. So we heard a lot about traditional philosophy of science, scientific method just now. But things are changing the way we think of science, maybe. And so I'm going to start with data. It all centers around data and the scientific method. Sorry, I don't have a clicker, so I've got to come back and forth. The scientific method that we've all taught for years, and there's a lot of nuance to the scientific method, but in general, it's all around hypothesis-driven science. And we're all interested in causality. What's the cause of our discoveries? So all of our data is then, how we collect data is centered around the traditional scientific method. There's a lot of nuance we could talk about, what faith presuppositions go into the type of hypotheses that we create. But in general, this scientific method lived happy for 400 years until 2008. But something about this scientific method, it came at a time when data was at a premium. For example, we heard a lot about Einstein's general relativity. The experiments to really confirm that didn't occur until 50 years after Einstein's theory. The great redshift, the Pound-Rebka experiment in the 60s, that's when people really started to believe general relativity from an experimental point of view. So data was hard to come by. So then something happened in the last 15 years. And in 2008, Wired magazine declared that the scientific method was dead. And here's the cover of the end of science. What do they mean by that? Well, from the last 15 years have been unbelievable change. I used to teach physics, and I taught in 2000 that we knew what 90% of the matter of the universe is. Now we only know what 10% of the matter of the universe is. Internet. I was at Los Alamos when the internet was developed, and I thought it was our own private world, and we were working on, I don't remember the old machine, it was all command language. I thought, never my wildest imagination would I have dreamed that my wife would be shopping on the internet. So what a huge change. That wasn't that long ago. So this data deluge has changed everything about how we view data, and we're just coming to terms with it. Science is really just coming to terms with it. But I'm going to focus more on medicine on this topic. So what's a good example of what I mean? Well, we've moved from a causation, hypothesis-driven world to a correlation. With this much data, the claim is all we can do is correlate. We don't have time to derive hypotheses. We don't have time to talk about causation. We just look for correlation. Now, scientists haven't really jumped on this. Medicine is trying, which I'll talk about. But the business community jumped all over it. They don't care about causation. They don't care about hypotheses. They have one simple goal, is to make money. And the famous example of this is the diapers and beer example. In the around 2000, if you were a shop owner, you would organize your store according to some sort of social rules. And typically the diapers would be over with the female section, beer would be over with the shavers and the male section. That's the way they organized things. When we started to get point-of-sale data started coming in, sounds easy now, everything's computerized. In 2000, it wasn't that easy to get point-of-sale data. You had to structure the data, you had to find out, you have to get all the different stores to communicate this data, and then start to analyze it. What they found was some interesting things. They started asking simple questions. What are the two things that are bought most together? And what sprung up was diapers and beer. No one expected that. Complete surprise. So rather than worrying about the sociology of that, the store owner said, we don't care. We're going to put beer. We don't even care who's buying it. But the beer is going to be between the diapers and the cash register, and beer sales will go up. So that's a great example of how the data deluge sort of changed the way we think, and business jumps all over this. And it isn't just business, because In 2008, the government, 2009, I'm sorry, the government jumped all over it too. They realized there's a lot of savings to be had from data, from looking at correlations, forget causation, let's just look at correlations, see what we can find, who does better on what drugs, who tends to get what kind of diseases, how can we save money in healthcare. And so this IT department was signed into law with a stimulus package. And if you read the stimulus package, you would see healthcare savings over and over and over and over. So the goal was to do diapers and beer for medicine. Okay. Has that happened? Well, there's a couple of doctors and MDs in the room who would say no. And why hasn't it happened? Well, we've heard there's a lot of reasons. You have privacy concerns. We've also heard in some of the talks in the last session how medicine is still intuitive. People are making intuitive judgments. How do you structure that data? How do you create a medical record that can capture the insight of a physician? Hasn't happened. Just it might happen someday. I'm sure it will. But right now, that isn't the case we live in. Also, if you look at the FDA, they are the scientific method on steroids. We have a medical device, and to even design a medical device, you have to start with a hypothesis, present that to the FDA. What was your hypothesis? So these regulatory agencies, it's going to be interesting to see if they ever, or how they will eventually, how long they'll catch on to the correlation and ignore causation. Plus, in medicine, we're interested in causation. Dr. Pohl's talk, he talked about something interesting on how microbes, the strange thing, microbes seem to, germ-free mice seem to be less social than germed mice. And I don't know what that even means. How do you germ a mice and make a germ-free mouse? But apparently, there's all this going on. Good luck trying to get a causation for that. That's an example of just the correlation sneaking in. But anyway, so it hasn't worked that well for science and for medicine, but there's areas that we could apply real easily on this. And we applied some of these methods to brain data. And the methods we apply are inspired by Wheeler. We talked about general cosmology just now, and he taught me a lot about looking at the world geometrically. There's no action at a distance, everything's geometrical. And then another mentor of mine, Ray Davis, who just took long-term data on neutrinos, not knowing what he would find. That's an example of correlation. He found some correlations. So this idea isn't completely devoid in science, it's not completely gone. So what kind of brain data are we going to play with? We're going to play with the easiest kind of brain data you can get. It's EEG, scalp voltage. And if you're not familiar with EEG, it's just a voltage versus time series that comes off of the scalp. Now, it's very easy to do. Well, now, it wasn't so easy when it was first discovered in the 40s and 50s, but it's fairly easy to do now. But it isn't easy to make it inexpensive and collect a lot of data. So that's what we're doing. But what's amazing about the EEG is that we're sampling from some higher dimensional space, some neuron space. And somehow all those neurons seem to conspire to make four primary frequencies. You can see in this wave pattern, this is a beta wave pattern. This is a stroke person. And where the stroke occurred, the beta waves are really high. And there's the stroke. So that part of the brain is just gone, trying to find somebody to talk to. But there's these four primary frequencies on the scalp. So all these neurons have to conspire, talk to each other, form a primary frequency, get in resonance, and then that goes through the scalp and we measure it. That's still amazing every time I see these. And you can see the frequencies with your eye. So what this implies is there's a dynamic system inside the brain. And presumably, there's some underlying differential equation. It makes me happy to see differential equations on a whiteboard still. So that's the causal idea. We're going to ignore that. And we're going to say, forget it. The brain is too complicated. We'll never be able to identify a differential equation for the brain. So what we're going to do is we're just going to do correlations. We're going to play with the data. We're going to use geometrical methods. And we're going to reduce the number of dimensions to something we can see, 3. So in this 10,000 dimensional space, we're going to find the 3 that are most significant to us. And there's some precedents for this in the real life. You all see a shadow of a tree, which is a 2-dimensional representation of a 3-dimensional object, and you know that it's a tree. So you can reduce dimensions and still make identifications. Okay. So to do that, we're going to first test our whatever math we come up with. You don't want to see the math. Be here all day. I barely understand it. My students understand it. We're going to test this on a pendulum, which is a known dynamic system, assuming the brain's a dynamic system. And we're going to do a two-body pendulum on a string versus a two-body pendulum on a spring. We're going to try to find the geometrical mathematics that will give us a geometrical representation of those two states and see how well we can just sample just pieces of the data and how well we can identify where the whether it's a spring or a string. Okay? So when we ran our algorithms, we were able to always identify this data, whether it was a spring or a string. Okay, so we know our algorithm does. Our algorithm does identify data from our dynamic system. Okay, that's all we know. Now we're going to abandon ship and just correlate. And we're going to first thing we're going to play with is PTSD. So in our database, we had 50 people who've been in a car wreck, no trauma, no bleeding. And they said they felt weird, they're depressed or anxious, symptoms of PTSD. And some of these car wrecks were 20 years removed from when we got the data. And then we had a group with the same number of controls. And so we said the computer, we took this space, we ended up with a 10,000 dimensional space. And we said, we did a blind cluster, said find the three dimensions, there's two states here, we didn't tell the computer who was who. So there's two states here, give us three-dimension clusters if you can. And so the computer created the three-dimensional clusters. Red was the people who had been in an MVA, motor vehicle accident. And the blue were the people who had not. And it found all of them and clustered them blindly. We don't know, when I talk about correlation, not causation, we don't know what these dimensions mean anymore. We've lost all connection to the causation inside the brain or the differential equation inside the brain causing this response. But we know that we could create a geometrical picture of these people. And we saw pretty much all of them. So whenever we did a sample, patient would come into our database, throw the patient to see who they were. The controls always end up green. Green is the sample patient. Controls always ended up in blue, and people who had been in a car wreck always ended up in red 95% of the time, 95% sensitivity specificity, without worrying about anything, just correlating. Those are RLC curves. And so that was fun. Then they said, well, how about Alzheimer's? It's a big one. Can we cluster Alzheimer's? Well, Alzheimer's is also easy to cluster, you know, red versus blue. It's a very extreme state. And whenever we put a patient in with Alzheimer's, they'd come up with Alzheimer's state, and non-Alzheimer's was non-Alzheimer's. But the interesting thing is, how about we got lucky or unlucky? This is medicine's kind of a funny thing. In our database, we happen to have people who were 5 and 10 years removed from getting Alzheimer's. So they came in from some other experiment as a control. We got their data, and we threw them in here. We found out the computer identified everybody who would get Alzheimer's as neither not Alzheimer's or control. That was very interesting. What does it mean? Again, we don't know. Take 10,000 dimensions, reduce it to three, but this is a very powerful technique. Because there's stuff you can do about Alzheimer's, by the way. We'll talk about that later. I've got some physicians who can tell you about things that you can do. So that's what we're doing. That's what I meant when I say I'm talking about correlation versus causation. And the brain's perfect for that. But now the question is, if the scientific method is dead, and it's not dead, this is tongue-in-cheek, obviously. You all are participating in the scientific method all the time. But the question is, but this next generation, maybe not so much. When I'm working with students at CU, they have this toolbox now, the math toolbox, and they no longer worry about where it came from. Does it work or does it not work? And especially the machine learning folks, they're notorious for this. The method we used was Laplacian eigenmap, which is a graph Laplacian. Anybody who's taught math, you know what the Laplacian is. So I had the students, I made them prove to me that the graph Laplacian was the same as Laplacian. They looked at me like I was crazy. Maybe I am crazy, but the way they're thinking now, there's just too much data. We don't have time to prove all these the mathematics behind all of these tools. Does the tool work? Does it not work? And we just did a hackathon at CU a month ago, and this is even worse than I've ever seen it. They just grab whatever tool they can get from MATLAB, and anytime someone comes up with a new algorithm, throw it on MATLAB, and these toolboxes are getting huge. Nobody's worrying about causation. Where do these come from? What's the proof behind it? It's do they work or do they not? And so I'm starting to think this is going to change how we teach science faith, how we think about science and faith. And some questions I ask for you all is, the methods are clearly changing. How we approach problems are clearly changing. The next generation will be thinking completely different than we are. They already are. So what's next for the science faith discussion? Will we end up with more Wittgensteinian pragmatism, for example? What I mean by that is God just another linguistic tool in the toolbox? Are we going to move away from talking about God and the fine-tuning of the universe and the is the creation account consistent with cosmology, and just say, how useful is this word God for our toolbox? That's an example of some things I think will come on the horizon in the future. And then the question is this a bad thing? Is it bad to talk about God as a linguistic tool? And that's my 20 minutes, and that's all I have to say about that. I was told 20 minutes. 2 minutes talk. Oh, man. Impressive. Okay, I talked too fast. But anyway, ask questions, because this is... Yep.
One of the examples you didn't mention was about actuarial science. I'm not sure that they don't care necessarily about causation either. They're looking for correlations.
Yeah, that's right. And it causes me troubles for me because they say I'm a high risk sometimes when I don't think I'm a high risk. But yeah, very much. Yeah. And with all this data, they can do a lot.
Just to push back a little bit on, on the idea that correlation is enough. You know, and there's no point in looking farther. Isn't it at least looking at which eigenvectors happen to predict Alzheimer's or whatever? Say, well, maybe if you ask the question about causation, you might learn something. It might be hard, or is the way that you get those components, you know that all information of causation has been lost.
Yes. Yeah. All information is
not
lost. Right. But, and I don't want to push the point too much, that there's still causation is important to us. I want to know what part of the brain is at work, but in this case, all information is lost, and it's quite possible that we'll never know why the brain is doing what it's doing. What is the soul? What is the spirit? This transhuman stuff. Fascinating. That's really neat. But is the brain so complicated we can never know a true cause? And my hope is that's the case, because I would select the idea of a complicated brain. But I don't want to overstate the case, but it's real. Just worrying about correlation is something that's happening.
There's a saying that art is science with more than 7 variables. And I make my living in online marketing and Google AdWords and Google Analytics and Facebook advertising, and it's ferociously competitive. And so these problems come up all the time, and you have to figure them out if you want to meet payroll this week, okay? And
I bet they do.
And so we call it the problem of attribution. And so, okay, so we have 10,000 people a day hitting this website, and we're selling something to 1,000 of them, and some of them buy when they hit the very first web page, and some of them it took 16 emails and 6 trips back to the website and a webinar and a YouTube video, and there is, you can't really say that there is any one thing. It's actually a whole series of things, and it's different for different people, and people are very complicated. But it would be a huge mistake to say that people aren't actually interested in the causation. They're extremely interested in the causation.
Sometimes.
But at least in my business. Yeah. But it's very messy And the good news is you only have to be good a statistical percentage of the time, has to be good enough, and then you're okay. But you have to keep improving it. And so cause and effect is a very, it's kind of elusive.
You don't think the scientific method is dead? You don't think wires?
No. But what is, I think, the real problem is people thinking that they don't have to think because all the computers do all the thinking for them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's the real. It's a cultural thing.
Yeah.
There's a very strong correlation between the wearing of dresses and breast cancer. So we need to be able to think because you don't want to end up making stupid decisions like banning the sale of dresses.
We have a question up here.
Yeah, that's assuming correlation is causation, and it's not. Yep.
Yeah. Wondering a little bit about how you define what an outcome is. You know, if you have all this data on outcomes, and presumably we're searching through to figure out if something worked, how do you define those parameters, right? What are you looking for? How do you know what you're looking for? And is that driven by patients' experiences, or is it still driven by doctors' intuitions about what they should be looking for?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's why the diapers here are so easy. We're looking to increase peer size. Real simple, precise. When we're doing what we're doing with the brain data, it's what we're looking for is medical data is messy, right? So to cluster these, we have to have a doctor saying, but in our case, it was a little easier. People have been in a car wreck, came into a clinic, feeling bad. So that's the criteria. So we wanted to look to identify those people. So that was kind of a clear cut. Experiment. But medicine is a lot harder than physics. You get messy stuff going on. Alzheimer's, another one, Alzheimer's isn't that well defined, but still, a diagnosis of Alzheimer's has similar symptoms, all different types, vascular dementia, everything's called Alzheimer's. But to see somebody before they got that diagnosis, and we knew they lost their memory, we knew they died. So that's also kind of a clean outcome for medicine. We do a lot of work with concussions, and that's a fairly clean outcome, where they hit on the field and they have to leave the field when they're knocked out. But yeah, it's a little messier.
And a NFL study was also a very interesting sample.
The NFL?
The NFL concussion study.
That was just, they said it was a convenient sample. It wasn't a convenient sample. It was a biased sample of everybody who donated their brains because their family thought they had CT.
I guess only going to be biased samples that we can use for this type of stuff?
I don't know, it's a good question.
So, I mean, I think it's...
Talk to medical people. Yeah.
So,
and I'm just a physicist.
So that's actually changing how we should make healthcare data in an unbiased way. So, are you familiar with the personalized medicine initiative by the NIH right now?
Yeah. Well, it depends on what outcome you're measuring, whether it's biased or not, right? You know, doctors, they don't agree on what depression means, or ADD, or in concussion, even know what concussion is. So it just depends on the questions.
Okay, we have a question here.
So one advantage of the scientific method is you get oftentimes to make a predictive model. Because you understand the causation. Is there any parallel to the predictive model?
Yeah, we have a predictive model. We can predict who's going to get Alzheimer's 5 years from now.
But what are the factors? Voltages on the scalp.
We don't know. Nobody knows.
Right.
To be honest with you. I mean, the only question is how well does this predict who will get Alzheimer's? That's the only question. We no longer talk about, this is one particular model we use that we don't care about the causation. So the only question is how well does it predict who will get Alzheimer's? That's it. So we're talking about causation anymore. It's just how well do we know?
Okay, so you need that.
In this model.
You need to start with the measurement, and once you have the measurement, you can put them on a chart and determine the likelihood of the development of Alzheimer's, but you can't say in the general population, these are the aspects that you look for that would be predictors of.
Right, it's just the data point. Mm-hmm. Just get as much data as you can, and then where do you cluster? And if you cluster high here, you need to do something. And what we find in other models we have is that the circulation has a lot to do with brain health. So if you're in this boat, what do you do? Well, there's a lot you can do. Statins, maybe, I don't know. Why do I say that one? But there's a lot you can do to slow it down.
Yeah. In my world, the data constantly gives you new ideas about the new experiment. So, I mean, there is a constant, because you're changing web pages and you're changing structures. And I would think that in most big data situations, there's all kinds of feedback loops back to, well, and it all depends on the speed of the feedback loop. So in Alzheimer's, you're dealing with a pretty slow feedback loop.
Yeah, your problems are much harder than this. Yeah, here you have
right.
You have one set control data coming in. It's scalp voltages, that's it. And you're limited by what the doctor's clinical diagnosis is.
The speed of feedback loop is a major determining factor in how meaningful all this stuff is, and it also speaks to what Emily was asking about.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's take one more question here.
Yeah.
As a millennial myself.
Yeah, I want to hear what you had to say about this.
I don't get out that much. I'm a nerd. Why else would I be here?
It's a good life, being a nerd.
A lot of what I see among the people I'm around, other millennials, is they don't really care too much about where the feed or your data comes from, whether it's proven scientific method, et cetera, or correlation. They just really care that it works. And
interesting. Yeah, that's my experience with your generation.
And sort of thinking, why not use both? Test the two against each other. I mean, if you have some sort of correlation here, obviously you want to prove it, but it's probably being done in various places. But
mm-hmm. So sometimes that's a good idea, sometimes you can't, because there's too much data and it's too complicated, like brain right now. But that's interesting to say that. And then for you, then this slide, we'll talk later, but what does your generation think about Philot when we talk about science and faith? Do they move over to the more pragmatic? You know, does God become a tool? The word God. Interesting. You know, there's a lot to that, and we won't know until 20 years from now. Yeah. Okay.
Let's wrap it up and thank our speaker again.